Hey, this meeting's being live streamed.
Happy
It's
Halloween, everybody.
Halloween. This is Value After Hours. I'm Tobias Carlyle, joined as always by Coach Prime, Jake Taylor. Special guest today is Chris Pavese. He's Broyhill Asset Management. We're going to find out what that is right now. How are you, Chris?
I'm
Yes.
good, Toby. Thanks for having us.
Welcome, my friend. Good to have you on.
Good to see Jake. Or I'm
So,
sorry, good to see Prime. I feel underdressed with you two here, but I didn't get a heads up. But
yeah,
what
what are you going as Mark Andreessen as
Yeah,
for Halloween?
I'm going as a Midtown New York hedge fund manager. Does that work? I can sort of show the best.
There you go.
Do you guys think? Is this an exciting market, or is this a, there's not much going on at the market in the, at the moment, or is there? What am I missing?
What market?
Things are getting interesting.
What's interesting? What are you seeing that's interesting?
I was listening to a few of your calls before this. I know you guys talked a bit about small cap, right? So what, small caps have gone nowhere in 5+ years. I
I think
think
it's like
there's
20, 25 years at this point.
yeah, you could say the same for China, right? Like I think MSCI China since inception is basically flat, or at least it was last time I looked at it. It might be down now, who knows? With markets, what was interesting is, well, it's a little bit different now with the S&P up what, mid-single digits this year, but there was a point where, right, NASDAQ was up, I don't know how high at the peak, but all driven by a handful of stocks, and the rest of the market is essentially flat to down. So there's things to do, there's things to buy, there's still plenty of fluff out there if you're not careful. People get run over every day. I think the name of the game, a good example of right what Charlie Ellis called the winning the losers game. It's just right. I think this is the type of market where, yeah, you don't want to swing for the fences. Just focus on getting on base and not striking out and not making too many mistakes is the name of the game right now, which is a lot different than the game that people have been playing for the last decade or so.
Yeah, buy every dip.
Chris, tell us a little bit about Broyhill and your background.
Yeah, so Broyhill started, well, before it was a family office, was an old Southern furniture manufacturing business. So brand was popular. I'm dating myself here, although I wasn't around back then, even back then, but on it's like I think it was the Price is Right or one of those like old school American game shows that popularized the brand and made it more of an American household name. Family sold the business in 1980. So the family office has been around since then. I joined the family office in 05 after a stint in New York with JP Morgan, hired down to run one of the family's internal equity portfolios. Long story short, appointed CIO in 2011, and then last year was a big year for the firm where we effectively spun out the investment management arm of the family office, which is Broyhill Asset Management, into a separate entity. So the Broyhill family is still our single largest investor, but they are one of a handful of investors today, as opposed to me being one of a handful of their employees.
And what's the strategy?
I wish that's probably to a detriment that I don't have a short, focused, crisp, clean answer to that. And that's largely because we don't really fit real nicely into a box.
Is your fa family office background, or but what's the let's talk the equity strategy then. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, no, even still, right? I'd say we're global opportunistic value, right? But all those words mean different things to different people. Today, the portfolio is about 50-50 US, non-US. We've owned things as small as several hundred million. We've also owned things as large as Google, Meta, Microsoft in the past. The other weird thing is, right, to a value investor, at least I think a lot of us have grown up a bit over the years, but we don't, value to us isn't a statistical construct. It's just, and it's not necessarily always looking for extremely high quality businesses or compounders. It's looking for mispriced assets. So it's right. It's looking at a future stream of cash flows, discounting that, and trying to buy it with a margin of safety. It's typically looking at things we can understand, which are generally pretty simple businesses. I think if you had to, if you know, put a gun to my head, I think our favorite setup is kind of a mid cap equity with a single line of business, 10K under 100 pages, as opposed to greater than several hundred. You know, Nintendo is a good example. I don't know if Nintendo is technically a mid cap today, but yeah, you know, that's the first 10K that jumped in my head. That's probably 60, 70 pages. We like special situations. We like, you know, we're not merger arb guys, but we play occasionally in activist and event driven investing. So our largest position up until a couple weeks ago for the last year plus was Activision. We also like, you know, we're attracted to kind of spin-offs and catalysts and that type of thing. So it's, you know, it depending upon your definition of classic value, it's what we'd call classic value investing. It's concentrated. It's 10, 20 names. I'll say long biased. We don't short individual names, but we will occasionally hedge when we can find cheap, creative ways to do so.
Cool. Let me give a quick shout out to all of the listeners. We have pretty good spread usually. Senator Mingo, are you always first in the house, Danny?
How's he do that?
I feel like Dominican Republic. I feel like that's always up there. Nashville, what's up? Antigonish, Toronto, Gulf of Mexico, what's up? Scott from Scotland, Durham.
Easy Cleveland, to remember.
Dino from Townsville, what's good? Savonlinna, Finland, always in the house. Castleford, England, that's a good name. Northern Great Plains, Dublin, Ireland, what's up? Minneapolis, Tallahassee, Guatemala, Brandon, Mississippi, Kennesaw.
How can it be?
It's crazy. I saw Lad Vegas somewhere there too. I don't know if that was a typo, but I thought that was funny. Bangalore. Skipped over you. Sorry. Lad Vegas. There we go.
Toby, get us updated on all your various metrics that we have to keep a weekly tabs on.
I'm a nightmare. Thanks for asking, JT.
I thought you were just happy to see me.
Yeah, this is when value gets cheap.
Yeah.
We're still inverted. Spreads still wide. I think last time I looked at the Gotham website, which has the is this a good time for value question, where he looks at, I think he's looking at like 1,400 names, top 700 out of 1,400 largest, looking at the earnings yield, EBIT on EV across those names. And then he has a 2-year forward return. And so we're in the 66.
Based on his data set of when it's been this cheap, here's what it went on to do.
That's right. So I think it only goes back to like 1998 or something like that. But he says 66th percentile towards cheap, which means that there's only 33% that are cheaper.
These are wild swings. I mean, when we were talking
about this.
What
site is this, Toby? And what's the data
Gotham,
set?
Gotham.com.
Yeah.
Okay.
Greenblatt's proprietary data set.
Greenblatt's thing. Yeah.
But we went like 92, and then I feel like we checked it again, and it was at like 40, and now it's back at 66.
It was over 90. It was in the 90s. Do you remember? Did we get
Yeah.
92 or 94? How? I don't know. But that was March.
Yeah.
Can you believe that? And then there's not been a great deal of value performance over that period from March to now. And it's been below 50 and it's at 66 now.
I'm surprised that his metric, knowing kind of how he thinks, and we know the Gotham products a little bit. I'm surprised it swings around that much relative to like a more normalized. Right, the more normalized earnings metrics that are, I wouldn't expect to move that much, even in a year as volatile as this one.
There's been some weird stuff, you know, the Alpha Architect tracks the spread. It's a funny metric because it's the median stock out of 1,500, so it's the 750th stock versus the median stock in the value decile, which is the 75th stock. So it's 75 versus 750. And it got out, I think this year in June or something, was as wide as it's been. And it's closed pretty materially.
What was it, like four? Like blew out to three or four, wasn't it?
I don't know what the number was, but it was wider than it was in 2000 at the peak. It was wider than it was in 2009 at the trough, which were two sort of extremes.
Yeah.
It's not delivered a great deal of performance, I wouldn't say, over that period of time, but it's come in a lot, which might be might be energy getting caught in that bucket and energy earnings falling materially would be the only thing that I can think.
Yeah.
I just don't think there's much going on in that area. Sorry, Chris, go.
I was just going to agree with, you know, the valuation spreads really for the last several years, right, is something we've been writing and talking about consistently for a while. Seemed like it was to no avail up until 21, 22, when we were, right, like all value investors jumping up and down about people ignoring these big cash flowing, boring businesses trading at, you know, close to single digit multiples or double digit cash flow yields and instead buying things that had, you know, somewhere close to zero probability of ever earning money over the next 10, 15, 20 years. That's changed, but it's still, right, you look at some of the valuations and some of the market caps of these businesses that are still unlikely to earn anything over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. And I mean, there's billions, if not tens of billions of capital still making those bets. And I guess we're all, you know, as a group, we're slow learners.
I think there's a fair bit of bloat to still come out of the market, to be fair. I think there's a lot that's come out, but we're a long way from, I think we're a long way from, like, if you think about 2009 at the bottom or 2000, you know, through that period, I don't know what you call the bottom there, because value is sort of a different beast through there, but it doesn't feel like that to me. It doesn't feel like screamingly cheap valuations, even though we've been in a pretty prolonged bear market now coming. It's coming up on like whatever it is, 22 months or something.
Yeah, and I think in some cases, the valuations are probably there, right, in certain names and certain pockets of the market. For me, it's more so sentiment's just not even close, right? Like you go on Twitter and everybody's back posting their quarterly numbers. We'll see how much, we'll see the next few quarters.
Got quiet there for a little bit.
Right, posting their top 10 names. And it's just, right, like, you know, if you were, you know, dating myself again, right, but like 2001, 02, 03, that was like death by a thousand cuts. By like after 2-3 years, nobody wanted to be anywhere near equities. Like the value guys were happy, right? But everybody that was buying the NASDAQ and all those tech names, like they were gone. They were, and you know, if they were around, they just weren't vocal, they weren't talking, and they definitely didn't have the confidence they had, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years prior. Today's investors are as confident as they were before they lost, you know, 80-90% with certain managers last year.
It's been quite a run. It's been quite a run for the seven. Nothing much else has done anything. There's some stuff. Yeah. There's some stuff that has performed underneath, but it's mostly the seven. I've seen some statistics that say that it's the other 2,993 stocks are down. I don't think that's quite right, but it's not far wrong. Most of the performance on the market cap weighted basis, anyway, is in those seven.
Yeah. Well, what are you guys looking at, anything interesting these days? Where are you guys spending time?
I got a big chunk of energy. I got some basic materials. It's all in stuff that it's highly cyclical stuff that I think is cheap.
I haven't really found anything that's felt justified in displacing something that I already owned and feel like I know and feel comfortable with.
Yeah.
So far. So the hurdle has kind of been high to get into so I haven't been doing very much.
How well do you know Nintendo? Either of you guys know Nintendo? Because you raised it before, Chris.
Played a lot of Super Mario Brothers.
And Zelda.
Saw the movie.
Didn't see.
Do you know,
the
Chris, is it one of your holdings?
Yeah, it is. It's a core name for us. It's funny, we were... We first started looking at it several years ago, right around the time you had a handful of bullish calls that were absolutely correct on the Switch. We spent several months on it then, and I'm not sure what it was, but there was something that held me back from doing anything. I think it was just, you know, maybe just thinking that I was, you know, had this nostalgia like bias to my view that I was afraid was going to cloud the thinking. But like, it seemed really obvious then when you run the numbers, and even under, you know, typically when we model a bear, base, and bull case for everything. And like, even in our most aggressive bearish assumptions for Nintendo, like if the Switch was anywhere remotely close to what it turned out to be like, it looked like a home run. And that just made me feel like, and that was under like bear case scenarios. And that just made me feel like we were missing something. So we didn't, we ultimately didn't do anything, and just kept following it, I mentioned Activision before. So we've been, you know, we've been following gaming for a while, looking for an entry point there, because I think the secular tailwinds there, whether it's the, you know, I'll use a funny name, you know, whether it's the metaverse or whatever you want to call it. I think that's the one place where metaverse can actually be monetized. But there's so many, the secular tailwinds of gaming are super interesting. The fact that the software providers were moving to digital, so margins were going from, you know, nothing like similar to what we saw in music with streaming, right? From low, boring, cyclical to very high, recurring, cash flow generating. And then it was really just recently this year, on the pullback that we got involved finally. And that was largely because we've got, I think people got just kind of got stale on the name, sort of like the Switch got stale, right? It's year seven. The company, like always, is not given any guidance or expectation in terms of when the next gen's coming out. So Wall Street's just kind of written it off and said it's dead money until then. Meanwhile, right, in year seven of a console cycle, they can put out numbers like they did this year with the launch of Zelda, right, with the Mario Brothers movie. It seems like you've got a number of catalysts lining up over the next couple of years, whether it's new parks launching, the Mario Brothers movie, and then basically signaling, right, that for the first time, maybe they're actually going to do something to monetize this.
All this IP,
unbelievably valuable IP they've got. I don't think. Well, Disney's probably not the best analogy right now because Disney's in the doghouse. Another great example of like, it's amazing how quickly sentiment goes from one extreme to the other. Right?
Oh, in this man.
I mean, Disney was on everybody's wish list of like forever business
streaming.
Yeah.
10 plus years, and now nobody will touch it. Right? Like, it's just. And that's one that's been on our list to start revisiting for that reason. But, you know, back to Nintendo. Yeah. I just think it's one of these cultures where it's counterintuitive, right? Like, so a lot of times people will punish companies for not pandering to Wall Street, or not having a shareholder first mentality, but there's so many examples, right? Like, I think the one that comes first and foremost to mind is like a Valiant, which is really extreme, right? Where that shareholder first mentality can get you just into so much trouble, right? And it's the difference between that and a customer or stakeholder first mentality. And then you can look at Amazon. I'm sure there'll be a point in the future where Amazon will be in the doghouse, but right now, right, like Bezos in terms of the customer obsession could do no wrong. Could look at Costco, right, the scale economic shared model and both those examples. And I think Nintendo, the culture there is so unique. And I think it's impossible to replicate anywhere else this day and age. All they want to do is create fun games for kids, families, and just, you know, drive this creative culture and do things just for that reason. And if you just do that, right, and if your sole focus is taking care of your customer, like, you have to believe that ultimately that's in the best interest of shareholders, even if Wall Street wants you so badly to focus on what you're going to do next quarter. When are you going to roll out this console? And it's just like, listen, we're going to do it when we have something that's worth rolling out. And that's it. That's all we've got to tell you guys. And like, you go back decades and decades and the company's always operated that way. And it's been the right way, right? Like, you can argue it's been the right thing to do. So it's, you know, when you find a business like that, we'd love to own a portfolio of businesses like that. I don't think there's that many, and I don't think there's rarely that many that you can get at the right price. For Nintendo, for us, it's somewhat of an exception. I'd say every other name in the book, we've got pretty close to what I'd consider pinpoint estimates on kind of what we think the business is worth under multiple scenarios. I did an interview recently with Value Investor Insight, and this was, I think, a little frustrating for John over there, and that, like, you know, because he wanted us to talk about Nintendo so bad, and it was the one where it was like, I don't really have good numbers. I just know, like, sometimes it's just enough to know that this isn't the right price, right? And it's just like, under so many scenarios, it's so hard for us to envision money or envision losing money. where it's like, if it's the right business, you can just feel good that over time, they're going to make you plenty of money. So if you just focus on like the downside, and I know that's cliche in our business today, but like, I think that's a great example where sometimes trying to get, you know, sharpen your pencil and get real granular and get real precise on something that's just a guessing game at the end of the day. You know, not being able to do that, it isn't always a reason not to make a decision or not to make an investment. But it's rare for us, and Nintendo's a good example of that, where again, like with the next gen Switch, not, you know, one, we don't know when it's going to be released. We think it's next year, but that's just a guess. And then two, if it's released, like the range of outcomes there is so massive. Like,
yeah,
it almost doesn't, like, yeah, we've got numbers, but like the numbers are almost meaningless.
Yeah, you're almost betting more on emergent properties of a system than you are on predictions.
Yeah. And they've just got so many levers they can pull, right? Like, we don't know how aggressive they're going to get in monetizing the IP. We don't know the economics, the shared economics with Universal and the parks and how much they're going to make. We don't know. We can estimate what they're going to make in with Mario and other movies, but like, it's just, right, like it's back of the envelope, and we can fool ourselves by putting, like, you know, multiple decimal points into Excel. But at the end of the day, yeah, we know the business. We like the business. We like the management team. We think they've been sending all the right signals over the last couple of years, albeit still probably not enough to make most investors happy. But it's pretty clear to us when you look at the history of the business and the history of the management team, they've come a long way in the last couple of years, just in terms of how they've thought about creating and monetizing what they've got.
Good balance sheet too.
Yeah. I got a couple, wild stat for you guys here. Apple and Microsoft together represent 14% of the aggregate weight of the S&P 500. The energy, real estate, utilities, and materials sectors represent 12% of the S&P 500. Four sectors against two companies.
Yeah.
Do you think that is wrong? As a reflection of its sort of impact on the economy.
Question for me or Jake, Toby?
That's an open question.
I'm going to let Chris take this easy one.
Oh, thanks, man. It's tough to say wrong, right? Like, it's tough to say wrong. I think it's a reflection of where the markets have been. I think it might not be a reflection of where we're going. Toby, I tend to agree. I would tend to think, you know, put a gun to my head, I think you're probably right, being, you know, focusing on energy and cyclicals and that type of, right, more cyclical, real aspects of the economy. Our hit rate there is lower than elsewhere. So as much as for the last year or two, we've been looking and poking around those markets, we haven't done a whole lot because our own sort of hurdle to get involved has to be higher just because I know our hit rate is lower, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's a tough area to invest. The only reason I ask is when you put together a market cap chart, looking or even just a revenue chart, looking at the size of those businesses relative to other businesses, like they're
huge.
They are on a different scale. Like, they're so much bigger than everything else that's around there. I remember looking when the airlines fell over when Buffett punched out of the airlines. I remember looking at the airlines. They were like, I can't remember now.
Round exactly. A zero feels like.
They were like $30 billion kind of market capitalizations at that point. And that was against, like, Google was at like 1.7 trillion, something like that. I was like, yeah. Google could go through and buy all of the airlines with its free cash flow in a year.
You know, yeah.
They're just on a different scale.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, there's a great chart, and I've got a letter keyed up that I wrote. I actually wrote it for our mid-year letter back in June and decided our mid-year letter was already way too long. So I cut it out and I was saving. It's called AI Insanity. And there's a chart there that we borrowed. I forget where we, quote unquote, borrowed from somewhere else. I forget where we borrowed it from, but it shows, there's that classic chart of stock market cycles, right? That shows kind of like, buy the dip and where people puke and where, all in. And then it's like the trough of disillusionment. There's a similar chart on tech cycles. And I think going back again to 99, 2000 makes sense where like, the internet stocks peaked in March 2000, right? And that was the peak of, expectations for the internet. But the internet didn't peak in 2000 by any means, right? So like when people look at that today and say like, there's no way like AI is going to be smaller today than it is, or it's not going to do all these great things. And they're probably right. But that doesn't have any, that has like, there's the correlation between that statement and the valuation of the underlying stocks is zero, if not negative. Right. And there's just, there's a period where the stocks are going to get, like you saw on the internet, where it takes multiple years for that just kind of sentiment to be washed out. But in the meantime, like the technology is progressing and the use cases are progressing. And it's just, it's a multi-year transition. There's a great book, and I referenced this in the write-up. And of course, I'm completely drawing a blank right now, but it's
Carlotta Perez, probably.
I'm sorry?
Carlotta Perez, The History of Financial Innovation and Technological Innovation.
It's similar to that. It's a different name, though. I want to say it's the I'm gonna have to circle back with you, Jake. I'm gonna forward it to you. But that's basically the premise. And I think I'm thinking of a different one.
Yeah.
And it's just like there's tons of books on like market manias and bubbles from Kindleberg to Ed Chancellor to Mackey. But then this is like the combination of that with tech innovation, which sounds similar to whatever book you're talking about that maybe I need to read as well.
Sounds like you already read it.
It goes back, right, like hundreds and hundreds of years. None of this is new.
Right.
Yeah. Mikhail Semenov has a great 200 years of value. And you can see in that, you can see the telegraph, the introduction of the telegraph in 1844 had a pretty big impact. The steam engine had a pretty big impact. All of those were like tech cycles. Yep. They look exactly the same.
Newspapers, radio, cars, right? Like auto was a growth market for how long? And it's an awful business. And somebody's got to tell maybe certain other people in the EV industry the same thing, but
they're finding out.
Are they?
I don't know.
So I'd love to talk. If you guys don't mind, I'm going to use this time to pick your brain a little bit too. We've been head down for a good 2-3 weeks now. So this is kind of technological change. It's somewhat pharmaceutical change, but looking for opportunities to fade the GLP-1 craze, which seems to be almost as extreme as the AI hype in both directions, right? Both the perceived winners and the perceived losers, and the going back to relative valuation and the relative extremes in the market. It's mind-boggling. Wondering if you guys have spent time there.
Do you guys know that meme that's from Mad Men where I forget which the guy was, but he's in the elevator with Don Draper and he says like, "I feel bad for you." And then Don Draper says, "I don't even think about you at all." And then someone took that meme and then they put GLP-1 is like, "I feel bad for you." And then McDonald's like, "I don't even think about you at all."
Jake, you got to send me that because I may need it for our letter if we want to do it.
It's hilarious. I guess McDonald's reported pretty strong this last quarter. I haven't looked at it, but I think that was kind of the takeaway of the joke.
I honestly haven't spent much time thinking about it for the reason that I just don't know. I don't think you can tell even which way it will impact. So GLP-1, I know that it has these properties where it makes people eat less and it makes you able to study better and do a few other things like that. It gives you a little bit more will or something like that, which is kind of interesting. But I just don't know that you can tell necessarily whether it's going to be a net negative for junk food or a net positive. Like if you can get the weight off really easily, why would you be disciplined about your diet, wouldn't you?
Let's lever the system up, right?
Yeah. I feel like you could go a lot harder through the winter months now. Like,
I like it.
Halloween, Thanksgiving, Christmas run through there. Like, just don't worry about it. And then, you know,
there's January, a pill for that. Yeah.
January.
I hope you're right, Toby, because I'm like ramping up in that sweet spot right now.
Yeah, it kicks off tonight. Silly season kicks off tonight.
You want to get nuts? Let's get nuts.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you think? What's your view? What do you think there?
So we've spent more time on the healthcare side of the equation. It's probably been 10 plus years since I've looked at this space, right? But historically, a lot of these big medical device companies have been viewed at, or at least at one time or another, were viewed at high quality businesses, right? With secular tailwinds in terms of growth drivers, operating depending upon what market and relative oligopolies, right? Limited competition. Some of them are starting to look interesting. You've got businesses, and I'm going to try to shy away from mentioning names because we're actively doing work and beginning to establish positions. But, there's medical device businesses that traded at historically, mid-20s type multiples that are approaching double-digit cash flow yields. And I just don't know. It's really like, so this is another example where it's tough to model out because even the GLP-1 data is still so early. We don't know the long-term implications, right? But like, I mean, you see forecasts for this being like $100 billion market in 6 years, effectively. You can back into that based on pricing and what that implies with population, and then like back into the impact on the addressable markets of those related companies. And it's like, doing that, it's kind of hard to get to how hard these businesses have sold off.
Really? Like, even if it was pretty bad for them, it wouldn't be like as existential.
You can look at, and it's also not clear, like everything else, right? There's positives and negatives. And I'll give you an example. So we haven't spent any time up until recently on some of the companies in the dialysis market. Yeah. Right. One of which is, Berkshire owns 40% of.
That is
treatment for kidney failure. And historically that market has grown, I think, at 2-4% annually in terms of population, right? And of kidney failure in the, let's just look at the US, right? GLP-1 has a great impact on reducing type 2 diabetes, right? Which is one of the leading causes. It may be the leading cause of kidney failure. But you know what? It's not the only thing. It's really only about 40% of the people that need dialysis, right? So like, first thing you can do is go, okay, let's just cut that growth rate in half. And let's just say they fix, right? Like type 2 diabetes. But there's still the other half of their, right? Like that volume growth that has been there that has been unrelated to type 2 diabetes has nothing to do with anything that GLP-1 is going to address. So like right off the top, you can just say, okay, what's it worth if the volume gets cut in half? And then you can say, right. And that's like worst case scenario, but then there's other factors like during COVID, right. These businesses got hammered because mortality surged. Right. GLP-1, and this is all coming from, my knowledge of the healthcare system and pharmaceutical space is not at all, I'm not at all qualified to talk about this, but we've had this conversation with our director of research.
This is a podcast. You're allowed to do it.
PhD in organic chemistry, worked for big science, worked in clinical diagnostic labs. And like, this is kind of where I geek out on financials, she geeks out on this stuff. And I have to like back her up and be like, okay, so translate that. What does that actually mean for the stock? Right. She'll get in.
Yeah.
But the reality is like GLP-1 in addition, so it'll keep some people out of dialysis, which is a good thing. It's also, I learned this recently, like kidney failure isn't something you fix,
Yeah.
Right. So if they're on it now, they're not going to come off it. And even if they came off it temporarily, they're going to come back on it at some point. So that's one thing. The second thing is, I think the mortality rate is something around like 18%. And so if GLP-1 can keep those people alive longer, like the back end of keeping people on dialysis longer may actually be a more of a tailwind to volume than the slowdown on the front end, if that makes sense.
Right.
Right. And we don't know any of this yet, but that's the point. Like, you can model out different scenarios and you can back into like what's implied by the stock. Like DaVita dropped, 25% on that last Novo test a few weeks ago. Literally, like it was trials. They stopped short, right? Because like it was clear that their endpoint, it was better than expected. And so like there were stocks that dropped 25% on that day, but like not a whole lot of information about like what that patient population is going to look like 10, 15, 20 years from now, right? Like we've had people on these drugs for a few months.
Yeah.
I just think it's super interesting. And there's other impacts too, right? Like, I don't know, like obesity is a massive problem in the US, right? But so we start cutting that back. I don't know, what's the first thing someone does after they cut 10, 15, 20 or 30, 40, 50 pounds, right? They probably look to tighten up some of that extra weight, maybe go to the gym, right? Maybe start.
I was going to say divorce attorney. Sorry.
We haven't gone there yet. Oh, are they publicly traded?
Second order effects. You got to look a little deeper into the.
These are very long term trends. It's almost like the VC macro kind of trying to predict something that's like really, really long way out in the future. Is that part of your process? Is that how you sort of work through it? You think about AI and where that's going and GLP-1 and where that's going, and is that how it works?
Not necessarily. I mean, I guess to be clear, Toby, like we typically look for, our turnover is relatively low, maybe 15 to 20% annually. We typically hold 10 to 20 names. So maybe that's a new idea or two a year, or sometimes quarter if we're lucky. We're typically modeling out 3-5+ years, and our turnover is pretty consistent with that time horizon. But we're also, right, we'll also look at things where, right, if we model out 3 to 5 years and we get that price in 6-12 months, we're happy to take it and move on to something else. I'd say not necessarily, we're not always looking at, uber long-term trends like this, but I think the commonality is we're looking for some sort of dislocation where the market extrapolates that out forever or longer than we are comfortable extrapolating it out. And like, right, AI and GLP-1 are good examples of that, where because there's still so much uncertainty in terms of picking winners and losers, or the extent of the winners and losers, we don't have to necessarily be better than anyone else or try to be better than anyone else at forecasting out that far. It's just a function of like trying to understand what's in today's price and what's reasonable or likely relative to, right? It's like anything else. It's just where the odds in our favor, where things stretch too far and where we can be comfortable kind of fading the popular narrative.
Yeah, I think one way to classify value investing would be that you're generally betting that the world is not going to change as much as everyone is predicting. So I wouldn't be surprised if you were able to assemble a basket of GLP-1 impacted securities. It would probably not be a terrible bet to make to just be long that, as people sort of realize like, oh yeah, maybe this does change things, but it's going to take a while and it's going to take longer. And there's going to be a lot of cash flow between then and that day that, the companies will realize still, and you paid a cheap multiple for it, and maybe you get a decent return because you were kind of took the other side of the bet.
And for whatever reason, I think it's just personality and personal preference, right? Like, you could argue the other way too, right? You could argue that, like, listen, these names haven't run nearly enough. There's so much potential here. The market is missing, right? Like, when we model this out 5-10 years, like, even our worst case scenario, the stock's multiples of where it is today, even after jumping 50%. Like, we could occasionally get there too, but I think we're just more, you know, we've got this kind of like misfit underdog mentality. I think probably that's common for value investors, where I'm much more comfortable looking for the other side of that. You know, talking to Primetime over here with the Colorado flags in the back, right? Like, it's just, you know, we're a lot more comfortable looking to fade than looking to bet something's going to be even more extreme than the consensus thinks.
Yeah,
not saying we won't do that, but that just tends to be more our style.
JT, you want to do your veggies before we?
Yes, sir.
Chris, we have to do the vegetables.
Obligatory.
Glorious Nation.
All right, let's hear it.
Learn something.
So today's episode is entitled "The Self-Serving Bias and Ant Mills," and we will tie these together. So the self-serving bias is this tendency that we all have, where we tend to evaluate things in ways that protect our own self-image, right? Like, when we succeed, we attribute it to our own abilities and or efforts. You know, I knew what I was doing. I'm smart. I worked hard. But when we fail, we tend to blame it on external factors, right? Like, my boss had it out for me, or that test was unfair, or I was just hungry and tired. I'm not an asshole. Yeah. The Fed ate my homework. So I was reading Shane Parrish's new book. It's called Clear Thinking. And he had a section in there that I liked. And he says, if you got some result you didn't want, the world is telling you one of two things. Either one, you were unlucky. And if that's the case, then, you know, you should probably keep doing what you're doing, and it's likely to start working. Or two, your ideas about how things work are wrong. And most people don't want to hear that they're wrong, right? It's a blow to our self-image. It hurts our egos. Instead, you know, we tend to ignore what the world is telling us, and we keep doing what we've always done and getting these same old, you know, bad results. And so, tying that together, I was on a long car ride with my 12-year-old this weekend to a baseball tournament, and he was telling me about this thing called an ant death spiral. And I was like, okay, well, hold on a second. You saw this on YouTube probably, so it's, you know, probably bullshit. So I was a little skeptical, but I did a little bit of my own digging when I got home, and it turns out that it's a real thing. But scientists call it an ant mill. And it's an observed phenomena where, in a group of army ants, they get separated from the main foraging party and they lose the pheromone track, and they begin to just follow one another around and form these like continuously rotating circles. And the circles are, you know, called death spirals. And it's because the ants eventually will just like march themselves to exhaustion. And the largest ant mill ever discovered was 1,200 feet in diameter, which, you know, in each ant, it took about 2.5 hours to complete the circuit for each ant. And so when we think about ants, like, their brains are, they're almost exactly one one-millionth the times the size of our brains. Some of you more or some of you less. But the human brain is 1.1 to 1.2 liters typically, and the ant is 1 microliter. And, you know, so ants have this very simple input-output functionality that's wired into this limited number of neurons. And, of course, we are much more complex. But it feels like we actually exhibit some of the same kind of ant mill behavior, where we keep making the same mistakes over and over again and not learning and adjusting. And, you know, we get in our own little mental death spirals where we're just circling around and following each other. And you like, the ants are kind of like, they stop asking themselves, like, are we doing something wrong here? And, you know, trying to check. And so, you know, they're sort of like maintaining this status quo of just following the ant in front of them. Shane has this pretty good quote in here that, if you want to see whether your thinking is wrong, you need to make it visible. And making what was previously invisible visible gives us the best chance of seeing what we knew and what we thought at the time the decision was made. Relying on memory won't work because the ego distorts information to make us look better than we actually are. So, you know, I think we're all sort of a little bit guilty occasionally of running into our own little ant mill where we're just circling around and we're not like kind of stopping to check our assumptions and check are we doing the right things. And a lot of times it's because our ego is holding us back.
Good one.
Super interesting, Jake. I got an ant book recommendation for you. Have you read any of E.O. Wilson stuff?
I have. I'm a big E.O. Wilson fan.
Of course you have. All right. I'll leave it at that. And I pulled up while you were talking, which it was driving me crazy. Engines That Move Markets. That was the book I was thinking of.
Yeah. I don't think I've read that one. I have heard of it. We had somebody asking on Twitter about Mao Boson's white paper and the total shareholder return question on they had, what was it? It was the S&P 500 growth versus S&P 500 value from 2007 to 2021 annualized. And this is like a kind of a decomposition of returns exercise. And I don't know, did you guys get a chance to look at that little table at all before?
Toby, I did have a look at it. Yeah, but I need to pull it back up again.
Anything surprising there?
How much of it was multiple expansion and compression on both sides?
So multiple expansion for value accounted for 1.6% of the 7.6% total return. On the growth side, it was 3.6 of the 13.3.
Yeah, so it was an extra 2 points there for the one that the shares outstanding.
That's the one that surprised me.
So that means that the value have been net issuers.
Yeah.
And the growth.
Over what time period?
2007 to 2021.
I wonder how much that is banks following the financial crisis in terms of dilution.
That's a good guess. Possibly.
That's all it is. It's just a guess, but that's where my head went.
I think you're right. There was some equity issuances in energy too, wasn't there? In like the, like they were raising a lot of capital in 2014, 15.
Yeah. Commodity businesses don't have a great track record of capital allocation.
You don't say.
I didn't notice any in Thorndike's book, The Outsiders. So I don't remember. I might be misremembering, but I don't remember many commodity businesses there.
Yeah, so 2% return profile for the growth from basically reducing shares. And that must have been like Apple and some other things that have just eaten a crazy amount of their shares back. I have to imagine. I bet if you like stripped out some of the outliers, I bet that probably looks a little bit more normal. But yeah, that was my biggest surprise too, that value was on the issuance side and growth was on the retirement side.
EPS growth was, as you'd expect, much more healthy for growth than it was for value. And I guess there's the share shrinkage contributes to that as well. But it was a big margin, 3.3 versus 8.
But the net income difference wasn't that much. It's like 5.2 for value versus 5.9 for growth. I mean, that's almost a push.
You clearly needed, net income. That's not growth. That's just net income. So it was net income 5.2 for value, 5.9 for growth. So does that mean that growth was cheaper than
No, you had the same amount of kind of call it business results-ish, but then the number of claim tickets chasing those business results reduced on the growth side and increased on the value side, which then gives you EPS differences of 8 and 3.3.
But they're saying net income 5.9% versus 5.2% for value. Doesn't that mean that growth was cheaper, 5.9%?
It sounds like that's net income growth, no? That would just be my guess.
It splits out growth.
No, it's change in net income that's attributing to the return. That's what it's trying to say. Yeah.
There's an interesting. I'll flip it to you guys after this call. I did it and I presented it to our board last quarter. I forget who. But I think it was one of the Fed banks that published it that showed a return decomposition. Now this wasn't value growth, but it's somewhat related. It was a return decomposition from the 60s through the 90s relative to the 90s through today or something of that. I'm sure I'm butchering the time period. But it was what it showed was the returns over the two periods shown were almost identical. In one instance, I'm going months and months ago, go from memory, but it basically showed how like the biggest driver of the return delta over those two time periods was one, declining interest expense, and two, declining tax rate, corporate tax rates. And so, but when you looked at like the EBIT growth, like the sales growth and the EBIT growth over the two periods, like the lesser period from a return perspective actually grew sales and EBIT faster, but all of the difference was in the decline in tax and interest expense.
Right.
Which fast forward to today.
Can it go that any further in that direction?
And just the opposite, right? I mean, we're absolutely going in the other direction. Not to mention, and that's even before we get into unit labor costs, right? Like,
yeah, margins pinch.
And then you look at change in valuation, right? And like over that time period, and then look at where we are today and where you think we're going to be in 10 years. It's hard to make a real bullish case for being long spies here.
Yeah. Has Fed been reading Chris Bloomstrand's work? Is that what's happened? Wouldn't surprise me at this point.
Did you guys catch Munger on Acquired? The Acquired podcast, not the Acquirers podcast. Thanks to everybody who sent me the congratulations for getting Munger on.
Obviously, so far. I mean, yeah,
he picked the wrong one.
Best.
He probably got confused, or his mind has got confused. That's a VC podcast. Why would he go on that?
Yeah. Here we've been praying at the altar.
Wait, who are you two guys?
For years.
Now, any big takeaways there?
I haven't listened to it yet. I got it queued up, but I haven't had a chance.
To me, it sounded like he's playing the same old songs. I like the stuff that he plays. I like it when he gets up and he plays the classics, and he played the classics. There wasn't much new stuff in the. I like it when they get up and play the classics. I'm not going to lie. I go to my bands to see the classics, not the new stuff.
Yeah, I don't need your new stuff.
Save the new album up. Wait until it's been released for 5 years.
Hey, that's our universal music thesis in a nutshell, man. Thank you for that.
People like the classics.
That's it.
I like remixes of the classics, but I still want to hear your classics.
Yeah. Hey, as long as it's not Taylor reproducing them ourselves, we're happy. We're fine with remixes too, as long as we get paid on those.
Does that not feed back into Universal?
If she reproduces an album and it's played on Spotify, And you listen to that album or that song that she's produced, no, we do not get paid as Universal shareholders. But if that new album drives physical sales and stuff and people to listen to her older stuff or stuff that's still under Universal, then yeah, it still benefits us. It's not nearly as strong as her being directly tied to the label anymore.
Taylor's the only thing keeping the economy in the black at the moment. She was 6.9% of the contribution
GDP. Unreal. Unreal.
No, it's not quite. She's probably only a point of GDP at this point. Still like $1 billion.
I have to say I'm surprised. So my dad took my nieces, who are, you know, the perfect Taylor Swift age, to go see the movie. He was raving about it. Here's like a 65-year-old man. He loved it. I was like, although apparently it was a little long, but apparently it was quite good. I mean, I was shocked when he told me that.
Yeah. I'm still curious to see the impact on Kelsey's performance.
It's got to be down, right?
I think it's too early to tell, right? There's no statistical correlate.
I thought they had some stats up that showed that he's only won since she's been there. He's better when she's there.
They lost this weekend, so he must have.
Was she there?
I don't know.
Maybe that was what was holding him back.
I mean, if nothing else, just you know, you got to have a little less vigor in the tank, right?
I'm not touching that one, Jay.
Yeah, all right, okay.
So, what have we got? What are our prospects for the rest of the year? How do you like the setup, Chris?
Is it quite strong?
Toby. Cheap enough to. There's some stuff around, but I still don't feel like we're quite at the.
Wake me up when the high yield spread blows out.
Yeah, we haven't had that. We haven't had the panic yet. VIX can't get out of bed.
No.
old man?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's been the biggest, right? I mean, we've talked about like all these divergences and discrepancies, right? Like, chart bankruptcy filings this year and then look at credit spreads and like
makes no sense, right?
Explain that to me. I think we're going to have, like, you know, you saw in 08 and then in COVID, I mean, COVID was even on steroids, right? But you had this massive spike in defaults to 10, 12% the last two cycles. We've been saying for the last year or two, I mean, I think this is going to be a great environment for the distressed guys that have been like lipping their chops for the past 15 years. Yeah, I think we're going to have.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have 2-3 years of high single digit. Like, I don't think we get the 10-12% spike. Maybe I'm wrong. Like, you got to have some sort of financial accident to get that. But like, even without that, I think we just have multiple years of rolling high defaults. And that just seems inconsistent with where equity markets are. I mean, not necessarily small caps. The thing that's interesting about small caps, I don't know if you've guys seen this, but like, if you plot, so one, interest expense, you would, you know, people are surprised, I mean, intuitively, that interest expenses across S&P 500 or 1500 really hasn't increased.
Barely shown.
Given the backup in rates. But if you break that out by market cap, interest expense at small cap companies and micro cap companies is absolutely through the roof, right? The large cap guys have refinanced and extended everything out and termed everything out as long as they could when they could. Small caps are going to be crushed. We're going to be dealing with so many bankruptcies for the next several years. That's going to be an interesting opportunity set. But for your point, like, yeah, until you see credit markets wake up to this, I think equity markets have a long way to go too.
Bond markets are clearly in some agony. Bond markets are down.
Yeah, have you looked at TLT? I mean, it's Don't do that. Not make sure you haven't eaten recently.
It looks like a meme stock.
At some point, that's a reasonable long run. I don't know where it is as a hedge. I don't want to be the first one in. But
I mean, even so, right? Risk free at 5. When was the last time? Like,
been a while.
2000. You got to go back to something like that.
5% seems pretty nice.
I mean, but if interest rate cycles are, you know, 25 to 40 year phenomena, we're in
40. Yeah.
Yeah, this is like the first pitch of the first inning.
Yeah.
And are you ready to push it all in already?
Yeah. Okay.
I got some interesting stats. You know, I collect a list of these, like, just little tweets that have got little funny data points. So commercial loan demand has slumped.
This is recession indicator stuff, Toby?
Yeah, recession. Okay. Commercial loan demand has slumped to the point that's consistent with past recessionary periods. Here's a weird one. Cardboard box index is used to gauge consumer goods production. The output of boxes is believed to be an indicator of future production of consumer goods, since it's so common for packaging and shipping. According to this index, a US recession is lingering. We're still in one. There's a few of these sort of funny things around. LMI, Logistics Manager Index, hit an all-time low. Quiet implosion of activity occurring in the freight sector. And we've seen a few.
Berkshire's, like, BNSF's volumes are off. I think they're off 10% or something. That's pretty material.
And there was also, there's been a freight, it's a funny sort of, I don't know what it is. It's not a, but there was that freight company that collapsed last week pretty big.
Oh, Convoy.
Convoy.
Yeah. Trucking employment, transportation employment. You look at temp staffing has fallen off a cliff. You look at job openings have fallen off a cliff. Everybody points to labor and employment as such an indicator of strength. It's such a late cycle indicator, but there's leading indicators under the hood of employment, all of which are just completely tanking.
Right.
Housing.
The other thing that's interesting, Toby, you mentioned the yield curve, like when we got started. There's data that shows, right, the magnitude and duration of inversions correlates nicely with the magnitude and duration of recession. And on both those measures, this has been one of the longest and deepest. Mm.
It's
the other interesting point is, when it inverts, that's been a probably the single best predictor of recession historically, if you had to point to any one indicator, but the lag is totally unpredictable, right? What's more predictable is when it starts normal, right? When it reverts, like it's doing now, and you go from deeply inverted and it starts shooting straight back up, you're getting much closer to, like, that's a much closer real-time indicator, which is kind of scary now that everybody is completely written off the, right? Earlier in the year, it was like 100% certainty we're in recession. Now there's like every single buddy you talk to is soft landing camp.
It has happened.
Careful, you're going to happen. Yeah, be careful. You're going to give Toby a full full horn there.
Toby, am I singing your song over here?
That's my song. Folks, that's full time. We made it to the end.
How they get in touch with Chris if they want to?
Yeah, Chris Pavese Broyhill. How do folks get in contact with you if they want to?
Well, first thing you should do is go to the website, which we just relaunched after spinning out. So that's just broyhillasset.com. I'm also on Twitter periodically. I don't even know what my handle is, but if you look up Chris Pavese, I'm sure it'd come up somewhere.
Perfect.
Cool. It's good seeing you, buddy.
Thanks, folks.
Thanks for having me, Paul. This was fun.
Pleasure. We'll be back next week.